Today, we welcome Dr. Ian McGilchrist to Radio Sky as part of our Christmas programming. Ian, it's a real pleasure and an honour to have you here at the radio station. I have lots and lots of questions for you today. But first, Ian, we've brought you here because you're a psychiatrist. You've written many books, including probably the most famous one, which is His Master and His Emissary. And also in 2021, The Matter with Things, amongst other books on the subject of the brain.
Mm.
I saw your film, The Divided Brain, which came out in 2019, last year. It's a Sky Community Cinema, which was fabulous, which was the first time I'd really come across yourself and the idea of The Divided Brain, which I was absolutely fascinated by. So welcome today. I'm going to let you introduce yourself a little bit, tell us more about yourself, and I guess what got you into psychiatry, and also what attracted you your move to Sky?
Well, that question is perhaps an easier one to answer. For my name, you can tell my dad's a Scot.
Yes.
And but we lived in England, and we used to take a lot of family holidays up here in the northwest, the Highlands and Islands. And I developed early on a feeling that Scotland was where real life was. There was something vibrant and exciting and somewhat romantic about being up here, as well as the simple beauty of the natural landscape. And so I developed a feeling about it and identified as a Scot even while I was living in England. And then I've always had it on my agenda to find a place in Scotland and come and live here. But for most of my career, I suppose, I've been in Oxford and London. But I found the house that I now own by accident. I was up here on holiday in the 90s with my then wife, and we went to Talisker because I'd never been, and I looked at the map and saw that it was a long single track road ending at the sea in a rather amazing looking place. And so I said, well, let's go, and if all else fails, we can go to the distillery.
Indeed.
Which, and we went, and we walked past what is now my house, as you do if you want to walk down to Talisker Bay. And it was very much less frequented then than it is now, as the whole of Skye, I guess.
Yes.
And we had Talisker Bay on a glorious September evening, all to ourselves. And it was a sunny evening. It was this great waterfall, a river falling over a high cliff, the islands looking like everybody's storybook idea of islands out in the sea.
Yeah.
And then we walked back and saw the wonderful shape of Frieshall Moor behind the house. And as we got closer, I looked at the garden and I thought, this is amazing, because this is a very wild place. And in the middle of this wild place, there is this very civilized garden. It reminded me actually of an Oxford College garden.
It does.
Yeah. Yes, it's got a sort of degree of formality, and, you know, natural beauty. And I just thought, goodness, if that house ever came up for sale, I'd love to buy it. And I almost put a piece of paper through the letterbox, but I thought it was a bit rude. And I later discovered, later that evening, that it was being lived in by a young couple. They'd come from Australia. They'd inherited it from their father. It was a very, very successful B&B. So I thought, well, I can cross that one off the list. And then, you know, months later, perhaps even a year later, or actually several years later, I was just, as you do perhaps once every 6 months, idly Googling houses in Scotland. You know, you've got all those things you've got to get today, like loo rolls and yogurt.
Yes.
And things like that. But you have another list for things you'd like to do, like brush up my piano skills and go to, you know, move to Skye or move to the Highlands. And this house, Talisker House, came up for sale. And the rest is history.
Goodness. Well, do you know, it's one of those houses that I've looked at many times, and I've walked down to Talisker Bay and thought, I wonder who lives there. It's fabulous. And it does have that garden that you just, it's unexpected to see
it
such
is.
A beautiful manicured garden.
Well, I'm lucky that I have a very good local gardener. Ginny Gifford, and she with me and a friend who's a garden designer have sort of brought the garden up a bit from what it was like when I inherited it. But it's very beautiful now, yeah.
Yeah, that certainly is well. Ian, let's chat about what got you into psychiatry, because it wasn't necessarily your first choice.
No, it wasn't. Well, I've been unorthodox in the paths I've chosen, because from very young I was equally attracted by science and by the arts, the humanities. And at school I started off, my dad was a doctor, his dad was a doctor, my grandfather on the other side was a scientist, and they had interested me in science very much. So at school I you know, really got into science. And then it struck me that actually even more interesting was the way in which this related to what we call the humanities, so things like literature, languages, philosophy, history. And that was where I then went. And I applied to read philosophy and theology at Oxford. In those days, I had an idea I might become ordained and probably go into a monastery.
Okay.
And I'm very glad I didn't, for quite a lot of reasons, some to do with me and some to do with the poor monastery that would have got me. Instead, I was persuaded to read English literature, which was the entrance exam I'd done, which I did and very much enjoyed. Shortly afterwards, I got a fellowship at a college at Oxford called All Souls College, where it enabled me to read widely without pressure, to interest myself in a lot of things. And I did. I learned some other languages. I investigated art history. I also spent a lot of time going to philosophy seminars. So this was all very good. But to cut a long story short, there seemed to be something wrong with what we were doing in the English faculty, which was taking works of art that people had written, you know, some time ago in order to communicate something they felt was important. And we'd sort of eviscerated it. We took it and we took it apart and we paraphrased the meaning so that it became utterly banal. I mean, it's the same mistake as explaining a joke. Once you've explained it, it's got no power. Yeah. We made something that really needed to be implicit in that way, explicit. We made something very concrete, abstract, and something very individual, general. And I thought, this is not right. And I went to seminars on the so-called mind-body problem, and they were just too disembodied. So at the end of all this, I decided there was only one thing to do, which was to investigate it in the most embodied way I could think of, which was by becoming a doctor and dealing with people whose brains or bodies had in some way altered their mental world, or equally their mental world had given them changes in their body, bodily illnesses and so on, because these things work both ways. The mind and body are really sort of one in many ways. And so I'm nothing loath. I after having been a don at Oxford for 7 years, I went off and became a lowly medical student, and qualified in medicine, did some neurology, and then went to the Maudsley Hospital in London, which is probably the most well-known psychiatric teaching hospital in Britain. Which was a magnificent thing for me. And I was able to look in that training at exactly the area that I wanted, the overlap between neurology and psychiatry. So that's how I got into it. I got into it from a philosophical point of view, as I've explained.
Yeah.
And I think that's always been my interest in medicine. I mean, the subject matter, if you like, is intrinsically fascinating. I loved every part of medicine when I studied it. Yeah. But my real interest is this philosophical interest between the relationship between brain and mind, and
yeah,
brain and our personhood.
Super. Well, as I say, I've got lots of questions.
Good.
On your theory of the divided brain, including, you know, where it leaves us with sort of current technology, potentially looking at sort of addiction to social media, education, and how we manage screen time, gaming, etc. for children, and other things such as our obsession with data, monitoring, yes, statistics, economic growth, this desire to continually grow all the time, how that affects the environment. Also, I want to ask you a little bit about how we're sort of caring for our elderly in amongst all of this in terms of, statistics and data. I'm intrigued by your theory of the divided brain, because it seems to answer a lot of questions, which a lot of people have said, actually. You've had quite some incredible feedback about the book, His Master and His Emissary, also The Divided Brain. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, well, the feedback I've got from a lot of people is that once you've seen what I'm saying, you can never unsee it. That they see it all around them in politics, in local life, and so on. And often people say that I've been able to articulate and bring more into their field of consciousness something that they had a deep sense of already inside.
Yeah.
And that's very good for me, because I think when everybody really sees something and has seen it already but didn't know how to say it in the modern parlance, then that suggests to me that we're probably onto something. And also the fact that I've looked around the world at other cultures, and in almost all of them they have myths and stories which relate to this idea of the brain being divided. So perhaps before, I'm very happy to move on to those specific areas, but perhaps it would make more sense if I give a very quick outline of how the two hemispheres differ. And this is important, because a lot of people have heard, I mean, it's one of those urban myths that there's nothing in hemisphere difference, and that it was all debunked a long time ago. And some of this is right. So there was a lot of theorizing about it in the 60s and 70s, following something called the split brain operation, in which people actually had the connection between the two hemispheres surgically divided. And that was to help people with intractable epilepsy. But it gave us a window into one hemisphere at a time. And the sort of things that people used to say, which you just have to put out of your mind, is that the left hemisphere is perhaps a little dull, but it's reliable, tends to be not very emotional, rather rational. And the left hemisphere is sort of less trustworthy, a bit sort of given to having exciting ideas, but really not somebody who's sort of creative, but without really being dependable. Now, the reality is very different from that. And so what I have tried to do is look not at what the two hemispheres do as if they were two machines, because it turned out that the division of labor, sort of pictures on the right, language on the left, emotions on the right, sort of general stability on the left, is not right at all. Both of them are prey to emotions and help us understand emotions. Both of them are involved in logic, both of them are involved in language, and both of them are involved in pictures. So that led a lot of people to say, well, there's nothing here to look at. But my my feeling is that's much too quick. Hang on, mate. Because just because whatever it was we said about their difference was wrong doesn't mean that there isn't some difference that's right. Mm. And the difference is in the how, not in the what. So both hemispheres deal with everything, but they deal with them in quite different ways. And basically the left hemisphere plays a sort of role in getting stuff. It helps us to grab things, and it helps animals all through evolution. It's been the part of the brain that helps animals focus on something they want to eat and get it quickly. So it's a kind of smash and grab raid. Yes. It's not particularly interested in the big picture. It doesn't even see the big picture. It's just interested in, I need to acquire that. And meanwhile, the right hemisphere is seeing the bigger picture, which includes, of course, a predator who might be after you while you're getting your lunch, and looking out for your mates and for your offspring. So these two kinds of attention produce two kinds of experiential worlds, if you like. Now, you may say, I'm not aware of inhabiting two experiential worlds, but that's because nature has taken care that this blending of the two should go on below the level of our conscious awareness. Yeah. And effectively what the left hemisphere does is to say, I see the world's made up of bits. It's things. They're mere matter. They're what I already know, familiar. They're explicit, they're abstract, they're representatives of categories, they no longer have any uniqueness, and they're effectively dead. And they're like a representation of life rather than life itself. They're like the way a map relates to the world that it is a map of. Whereas the right hemisphere deals with that real world in all its complexity. So it sees things that are actually always connected, always changing, never completely pinnable down, but full of rich meaning, which often has to remain implicit, as in poetry, metaphor, narrative, myth, ritual, music, all these other things. And where the meaning is unique, the instance of what we're looking at is unique. It's not just an example of, it's really something that's there for yes. us and that we need to attend to it. So that's it in a very brief way. I've left masses out, but that's the nature of the conversation. So when we come to look at the world around us, what I suggest, and this is what I do in the second half of The Master and His Emissary, I look at the history of Western civilization from the Greeks through the Romans, through the Middle Ages, up to the Renaissance, the Reformation, what we call the Enlightenment, Romanticism, Modernism, and now Postmodernism, and look at the ways in which they represent different balances between these two ways of looking at the world, because they very clearly do. Yeah. And what I think I've seen is a pattern where the world, or the civilization, I should say, begins in a very balanced way and is incredibly rich and prolific in producing great steps forward in science as well as drama and all across the board. And then over time, it becomes more stultified, more bureaucratic, more abstract, more concerned with consolidating power, and it becomes greedy, it overreaches itself, and then it collapses. And this is really a swift decline, which is produced by being locked into the left hemisphere, and that's where I believe we are now.
Yeah. So when do you think this kind of happened? In the film The Divided Brain, you sort of locate it around the Industrial Revolution time, where we became obsessed with producing of things and making money and growth. What happened around that time?
I think that's right. I think that is a very important step, but there was perhaps something in the air before that, the so-called Enlightenment, which was a very fine movement. It said we really need to think much more rationally about things, and it was a kickback against superstition and things like that. But unfortunately, as the left hemisphere tends to do, it went too far, and it thought it knew everything. And unfortunately it didn't. And it was this immodest belief that we could understand everything, we could create everything, we could make everything, that then fueled the Industrial Revolution, where we began to see nature rather than as a beautiful place that is our home, but as a heap of resources to be exploited. And we began making things that are all the same. Again, they're non-unique. They're kind of examples of a category or a kind. Yes. And they're made for their utility. And the value of the left hemisphere is always, what use is this to me? How can I exploit it to make myself more powerful? And that's really what the Industrial Revolution was about.
Yeah. And of course, now we're at this sort of climate crisis where we're now panicking that we've used up all our resources and trying to find out other ways to deal with that. This is fascinating, because you sort of can think of so many examples of where what you're talking about in terms of the left hand side of the brain, what it does and how it really has affected how we have the decisions that have been made in our modern world. Just thinking about in quite recent times, I suppose, in the last 20 years.
Yes.
things like the growth of how much time we spend on the internet, how much time we spend on social media, and just having these very much less sociable experiences, to spend all our sociable time individually,
yes,
on our own and in front of a screen. What's your sort of thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's largely, though understandable, regrettable. I think it's not a good direction to be moving in. And the way it relates to hemisphere theory is that it has a number of features that you would expect if the left hemisphere mindset was dominating. First of all, it would become abstract and disembodied. So you're no longer a friend in the sense that you're running around with that friend, playing with them, hugging them, you know, inhabiting their space and being with them and eating with them or whatever. But instead, you're sort of connecting with them virtually.
Yeah.
And also, you're finding yourself drawn into debates which lack all kinds of subtlety. So there are now, as we all know, certain things that are said to be non-discussable. You simply can't talk about them. But there are often things that are of central importance to the stability of our society, to the meaning of our lives. And the opinions on them are very extreme. And social media allows one to get into thought bubbles where you only hear confirmation of your point of view. Whereas for a society to function humanely, we need to give time of day to other points of view. We may decide to reject them, of course, but we ought to listen to them. We ought to listen to them with a degree of courtesy, and we should be not raging against people whose opinions are different from ours, but trying to understand them. Now, I don't think that any of this process helps any of that happen. And there's another aspect to it, which is that we are compelled to spend more and more of our time on the internet, whether we like it or not, because of the drive of capitalism, which is eventually to have as few people on the payroll as possible. Because once you've bought a machine, the machine costs next to nothing to run, but people require wages. Now, there's a lot to be said about that. A lot of people's satisfaction comes from the work that they do, and also from the workplace where they are with other people, which is a nourishing part of life. But also, it's incredible that people of colossal wealth, and there are now people in the business of AI and so forth, who have unimaginable and, in my view, obscene wealth, are making our lives more and more cumbersome in order to suit them. So, for example, 10 or 15 years ago, if I wanted to do something with my electricity or do something with the bank or whatever, I could ring up, I could have a 5-minute conversation, end of story. But now I can easily spend several hours of frustration going around the system. You know, can we help? Yes. And then when you go to can we help, it's like, is it one of these? And, well, not really. It isn't one of those. And do you still need more help? You can go back in. And all the time they're pushing you back into the web, but the web is not telling you any of the things you need to know. And it's offering you tick boxes, none of which actually represent your situation.
Yes.
So it's a degradation of human intelligence in order to make it fit something much lesser, the crassness of a machine, in order to enrich individuals whose values I'm not sure I want to enrich personally.
Yes. You touched on AI there. It's a huge topic at the moment.
It is.
I have huge concerns personally about it, that we are, although it's a bit like, you know, people sort of say, well, actually, you could do things a lot quicker. You could, if you want to write a funding application, you can just ask AI to write the boring parts about it. And then that make a lot lighter. But part of me sort of think, well, that, you know, what joy do I get being awarded something that I haven't actually done anything with? Talk to us a little bit about your thoughts on AI and what do you think is going to be the future. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, unless we change tack, and I'm not sure how easy that would be, We are going to get drawn into a world where more and more decisions are made by machines on our behalf. And you touched there on the lack of creative input from us. Doing job applications is arguably not a very creative skill. And there are things that one is happy to allow a machine to do if it really will do them okay, and as long as you're in charge of what it is that finally comes out. But what is happening is that the imagination, the spark of life, the joie de vivre, if you like, is being taken out of life for us. There are so many rules and procedures now laid down either by bureaucracies over large organizations or by machines working on their behalf that I worry about the young people. I remember my younger days were very untrammeled by all this because there weren't things monitoring us all the time. And we had a much more, joyful sense of being able to do things that occurred to us spontaneously. For example, my partner and I were in central London and we thought we're outside the National Gallery. Let's go in and look at, some of the paintings we particularly liked. And you can't do it spontaneously. You have to have made a booking in a slot online using your phone and so on and so on. So to that extent, you're all the time being controlled, like through barriers to slightly like one of those ghastly things where you're sort of fed into a system of zigzag walkways in an airport.
Yes.
This is the image of modern life. And I think it's damaging, and it's going to result in mediocrity, because by following certain procedures you can avoid, you hope, certain mistakes, although AI makes lots of mistakes. For example, it will make stuff up shamelessly. If you ask it to write your CV, it will invent something that never,
yes.
Probably this should fit in here. But quite apart from that, it's that it will never do anything other than the mediocre, because to get beyond that is to be truly creative, to use your imagination. And imagination is not just a random abandoning of the way you normally think and just seeing what happens. Imagination is a skill that we learn where we see something, we hear something, we feel something in the world speaking to us, attracting us, calling to us, and we respond to that. And to begin with, we're not quite sure what it is, but through this two-way exchange, this encounter or dialogue, something comes about. Now, a machine is not capable of this. For that, you do need to be imaginative, to be able to also have emotions, very important part of being human, to have, in fact, a body and to be aware of what it means to suffer and to die. All these things are part of humanity. And with people who have no knowledge of these, no understanding of them, become brutal, actually. So we're heading for a very cumbersome, very mediocre, very brutal world in which a small group of people have colossal power to control and monitor our every activity. That's the worst case, I think. Well, no, it's the worst case is that we end the world, but that is the bad way we seem to be going. But I think that it is possible to help in this situation, to redirect it. And I see my work as guiding people to see where it is this is leading and why.
Yeah.
And therefore to be more aware, more conscious of ways of doing things that will be an alternative and be more fulfilling. We all have to compromise with the technicalities of the world we live in. But if really only 3 or 4% of intelligent people in this country could see the essence of, I think, what I'm talking about by saying we're moving into this left hemisphere world, I think that we could avoid a path which could be terminal.
Well, I think a lot of people would absolutely agree with that in terms of, if we look at the trajectory of what the path that we're on and where it's leading to. You spoke about imagination, which might move into the subject I want to talk quite a bit is education.
Mm.
You spoke about that in the Divided Brain. I'm particularly sort of looking at children's education, school education. Mm. In the film, you were present at, can't actually remember the name of the place, but drama school.
Yes, I was. Yes. In London, but I was also present in, I thought that was what we were going to talk about, a primary school in,
yes,
in Edinburgh.
Yes.
And also in a nursery, actually.
Yes, that's right. Yes. I guess all three I'm sort of interested in. Education in Scotland is very much a drive towards teaching those core skills of maths, science, English, making sure children come out being able to read, write, do mathematics, which is important.
It is.
But it does seem in your discussion, and somebody who's from, you know, my background, having gone through art school, and seeing, you know, how much can feed into those core subjects if you do art and music and these kind of things. What is your thoughts on the fact that, you know, we're so obsessed with making sure that those teachings are done in those core subjects, and very much the drama, arts, music is very much put aside?
Yes, I think, well, there's two drivers to that. One is felt that somehow the STEM subjects are more rigorous in some way, and that there might be something a bit too airy-fairy about anything that can't be measured in the same way. And the other thing is the economic drive to produce people who will function well in a technical society. What I would say about that is that we need, I mean, I'm the first person to say we need core skills of literacy in mathematics, and a knowledge and understanding of how science works. But we also need, if we're not to become, in serious ways lacking in human depth, we need to understand the human psyche, the human soul, the human mind. And this we do through studying history as free of dogma as possible, so that we're not trying to be cleverer than people who came in the past, but to learn something from them who struggled to make the great successes of our civilization in making a world that is generally much more tolerant and civilized than it might otherwise have been. And if possible, to understand some simple philosophical principles, to be able, for example, to argue both sides of a question. I don't think any child should leave school without having learned how to speak passionately in favour of something and then speak equally cogently on what people would say if they were opposing it. It's a very important exercise. And I think they should also learn mediation skills, because in life they will be very important. This is another way of helping people who are at loggerheads to see other sides of the question. I think that children should be taught mindfulness in school as well. I mean, it doesn't have to take up a lot of the curriculum, but if they did even 15 minutes of mindfulness a day or a few times a week, that would be a very useful practice, because what you're doing there is stilling the left hemisphere's constantly chattering mind and saying, I just want to be here with what I'm looking at and not produce my thoughts and overlay it with that, but actually to be present for it, for once, to honour it, to understand it. So my idea of education is that it must be much more to do with furthering our humanity than just furthering technical power. Technical power has its uses, I mean, obviously. But the very important question is, what are we going to use it for? Because technology is in itself probably neither good nor bad. It just depends what you want to do with it. And some of it, of course, has helped us in medicine to be able to heal. But some of it is of doubtful value and maybe actually eroding and destroying the substance of a society. So we need to have comparable wisdom to our rote learning of procedures. And that's another point. I think education is too strongly geared to learning these are the right answers. In the exam, they will ask you this. The correct things you must say are these following six things. Now, I think if you've reduced education to the learning of a list of things that you then regurgitate, you have effectively destroyed education, because education is not that at all. It's not even about acquiring information, although that obviously must be part of the process, but it's about, as the word itself suggests, leading something out, drawing something out from the person. So teaching them how to think critically about any particular point of view that is presented to them, and to be able to think imaginatively. And that involves reading books, including non-science books, books of ideas and books of stories and narratives and myths and so on.
Do you think if schools were to make all those kind of humanities subjects equal to the STEM subjects, actually, you would get a much more all-round education, and perhaps people who weren't particularly great at maths would actually be more likely to want to do it more, because they're maybe being their sort of needs are being met creatively.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think actually that we shouldn't think of them, I'd go further and say we shouldn't think of them as wholly separate. I've been asked to give a lot of lectures next year in various places, but one of the themes I'm being asked to address is the relationship between science and the humanities. And there should never have been a divorce. There's a myth that somehow science and the humanities can never really meet. But not only can they meet, but they really need to be remarried. I mean, there's a very painful divorce that was unnecessary. And a good scientist, and many of them give the stories of how they came to their ideas. They came to them, in fact, imaginatively, not by necessarily following the scientific method. In fact, it's been claimed by a very prominent scientist, and I would agree with him, that it's very hard to find any instances of great breakthroughs in science that were truly made by the, quote, scientific method. A lot of work was done in a rather pedestrian way, it is true, but the insights were insights that were almost of a visual nature. They often describe seeing a form, seeing a shape, having a dream, something coming to them out of their unconscious mind, which resolved the problem. So a lot of our actually brightest and cleverest thinking comes from the what we call the unconscious mind. And a lot of that is associated with the right hemisphere, because what we mean by consciousness is often a very narrow spotlight. But the stage is enormous. The stage is nothing less than the whole of life. But while we are busy looking at this spotlight, we're not seeing the rest. But the rest is infinitely important.
Absolutely. Sticking with children, I as a parent, I have a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old. And it feels like, well, I look back at my own, you know, parents, their parenting. I feel like it's the golden age of parenting, in a way where they weren't constantly having to put rules in place. They had a much more freer way of parenting. Whereas now I feel like we're being closed in on it, and how to sort of manage children and screen time, and they it's almost like when it comes to sort of gaming and screen time and them looking at online videos, and I feel like we've kind of put our children, by giving them devices, phones at such an early age. I mean, the children in primary schools, and they just got to 5, 6, I have telephones, which is a frightening thought. But it was almost like putting them into a crack house and saying, don't take drugs.
Yes.
Behave yourself while you're in there. But you know, and if you do, don't get addicted to it. What's your sort of thoughts on terms of, is that associated with that are now this sort of left-hand side of the brain taking over, that we've become obsessed with just looking at something and not being able to see outside of it? I don't know. What is our connection?
I think it's manifested there in narrowness of vision, in hard and fast procedures, and in rules. The need to control everything. Effectively, the left hemisphere wants power and control. And when it doesn't have power and control, it gets paranoid. And we saw a huge leap forward of that in the COVID crisis, with the desire to monitor everybody's movements and so on. But it's not just parenting, although that you're absolutely right. My parenting was of a very benign and human kind. And partly we were lucky, I was lucky, I suspect I'm a bit older than you, but I was brought up in an era when it was possible for most households to survive on one parent's income. In recent history, that's no longer possible. So that's progress.
Yes.
Now both parents have to be totally frazzled in the office. On the other hand, not every woman, and it was mainly women, were happy being the person who looked after children largely. Although I don't think we should disparage people who choose to do it. It's a very important part of furthering a civilization that has decent human beings in it.
Yes.
But so my mother was a very important influence on me, more than my father, who was a busy doctor. And it wasn't all rules and so on. It was flexible and interesting and imaginative. And at school, it also was. See, one of the things that's happened to education is we must make sure that everybody gets better results or
yes.
something. Now, what this actually means is probably that the grades get softer so that it looks like you've succeeded. And at the same time, you micromanage what teachers do. Well, it's Monday the 19th of April. We must be on page 25 or something. And when I was growing up, we used to laugh at the French because that's the way their system worked. But in my education, my teachers taught, not at random, but they taught particularly guided by the things that they found revelatory and fascinating in the area we were looking at. And so I was constantly being stimulated and not just told, well, you must just learn this by heart and that's the end of it. So I think this thing about rules is very, very important. I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't want people to think that I'm soft on boundaries and discipline, because I'm not.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that we've gone too soft on them in many ways. And I also think that we shouldn't be frightened of stretching children. I think if they can't do something, they're interested to see how they can do it.
Yeah.
And it is far more invigorating, exciting to have tried to do something and then found out how you do it. And then you come home and you go, I learned how to do so-and-so.
Yes.
Whereas if instead you're just fed information, it's a completely different process. I'll just comment on the relation between rules and AI.
Yes.
AI effectively is, you know, a matter of following procedures and rules.
Yes.
And there is an unholy alliance between bureaucracy and AI. AI is like a kind of outgrowth of bureaucracy. And in my lifetime, bureaucracy has strangled so many things. If you're a teacher, if you're a doctor, if you're a policeman, if you're a nurse, your life is massively more controlled by filling in forms, doing paperwork, having to go online, filling out statements, doing meta-process, i.e. not getting on with the process
yes.
of being a policeman or being a doctor, but spending time on accounting for it and writing it down and having it ticked off and struggling with an AI system is, oh, God, I can't tell you, it's gone slow again. And then you ring the curiously named help desk who can't ever help you with this thing. So, I mean, this is the world we now live in, which our life is wasted. I mean, our time is precious. It's what we're given to choose what to be with in this world.
Yes.
And so much of it now has been hijacked by a combination of AI and bureaucracy working together.
Well, I think you're right. I think we're seeing so many people leaving the teaching profession, struggling to get people to work for the NHS. I mean, we know it's a huge problem here in the Highlands.
Absolutely.
And across.
It is everywhere now.
It's everywhere. As you say, it's because of that. That's the time taken to just do other things that are not actually what you think the job should be.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you're not trusted. as it were, to use your own judgment. Oh, that might be dangerous. Well, it's also very dangerous to over-control people because you then warp their work patterns in ways to fit this, and you exclude certain things that they would have tried, which were more effective, more empathic, took much less time. You're forced into this time-wasting procedure.
Yeah, indeed. Let's talk about what it feels like, the obsession of data, constantly the monitoring, data gathering, statistics gathering, that seems to have taken over from sort of real life experiences or trust in humans to make decisions based on experience.
Completely. And it's very sad. It's very important that we do something about it. And I'm constantly coming up against it, both in my own experience and in my writing and my teaching. This is exactly the problem. We've stopped allowing people to use their training, their experience, their judgment, instead making them follow a rather mindless procedure. And it's really a shame. I mean, I have a funny story I can perhaps quickly tell. It's not one of the most serious ones, but it's just an amusing one. I gave a lecture to the University of Oxford over Zoom a couple of years ago in the summer. And I heard afterwards that they were keen to pay me. I thought, well, that's very nice. I didn't really expect that. And in the old days, I'd have got a check in the post from the finance department a couple of days later, job done. But no, now the only way to do this was to go online to a platform. And this was only an intermediate step, because there was another platform that you couldn't get to until you completed this one. And I had somebody who was supposedly knowledgeable about this holding my hand while they did it. And neither of us could get it to work. And after 3 months, he moved on to another post. And he said, don't worry, someone else will come. This other person couldn't help either. We got into the second level, though. And I came up to a thing where I've just got to do this myself. And in order for them to pay me, I had to tick one of 77 boxes. So there were 77 choices of what I had provided to Oxford University. And I read down, and there was window cleaning, and there was catering. But nowhere in this list was giving a lecture, which seemed to me one of the points of having university. And so in the end, I found a telephone number for the finance department at Oxford, and I rang them up. And amazingly, I actually got a real person on the end of the line. Now, that's not going to happen in a few years' time. But I was lucky. I snuck under the bar. And I said, do you see the problem? I don't know how to proceed. And he said, oh, tell me about it. It's such a nightmare. It makes all our lives so frustrating and uses up so much time. And I said, okay, but how do I break out of that? And she said, oh, just tick any box and we'll pay you. So I ticked window cleaning.
Somewhere in a file deep in Oxford is Ian McGilchrist.
Window cleaner.
Window cleaner. Superb. Well, yes, absolutely. I think there's so many examples of where these things just don't work. These apps are to set up, or platforms are to set up to supposedly make life easy, but actually ours.
It's like your call is important to us, and in order to improve our service to you, we have stopped doing anything that used to be helpful.
Yes, exactly. Goodness, I'm intrigued by statistics and data, because one of the things that concerns me is that when you look at healthcare, I suppose in our environment here in the Highlands, and what has been over the last few years, this decline in accommodation for the elderly and shutting down of old people's homes. I know this seems completely off topic, but
no,
it does seem like statistics and data have driven us to be less compassionate and less understanding of what it is to care for somebody and what that means to care for somebody. And that's quite a worrying thought for the future, that we've sort of disconnected to ourselves.
We really have. I mean, where in a pile of statistics will you find compassion? nowhere. You only find it in a human being. And if we abdicate our role to machines and are over reliant on them or on statistical measures, which have their uses, I mean, come on, we need some data.
Yeah.
But there's a fetishization that the data will solve and solve our problems, tell us what to do. But they don't. There's a wonderful book which I can recommend, and I can't unfortunately now remember his name, the author, but it's called The Tyranny of Metrics. And it's really brilliant. It's shown how things go badly wrong. And we can't go anywhere unless we've got metrics to back us up. And this has some ridiculous consequences. So as you rightly say, if, for example, the contribution to the economy of old people being, looked after is a largely negative one because it's not we're going to get them back to work or anything like that, then this is somehow downgraded as in its importance. But the human tragedy is large, and of course it impinges on not just the person themselves who's in that plight, but of all the family and people who will need to somehow in their already overcrowded lives to be able to fit in this role. So I think, like in so many cases, we are moving backwards. We're moving away from a society where we knew a bit about how to care for people to one where increasingly we're not. And it's not just in that area. Take something like the arts. The Arts Council decided that it couldn't just give grants to people because they looked like their work was interesting and they might produce some more if they got a bit more money. It had to be operationalized and, measures had to be taken. And of course, you cannot measure these things.
Yes.
If you had a Raphael or a Michelangelo, there's nowhere in it you can measure its worth. You have to, this is something only another living human being can respond to and
yes.
measure. And so you get the ridiculous position that something that is, in fact, very highly creative may fail to be funded, whereas something else that has some nebulous utility attached to it, probably sort of worked into it on purpose in order to get the grant. But this is not the way we should be thinking about works of art or human beings.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because I used to work for Atlas Art. I worked for them for 8 years, And one of the things that we used to always do, we were Creative Scotland funded, and was one of the things that every time we did an exhibition or an event, we would have to fill in, get all the participants to fill in evaluations. And not within that evaluation, it wasn't just asking them about what their experience of the event, it was all about them, whether they had a disability, what their gender was, et cetera. And you felt like it was a lot of data gathering for Creative Scotland. And of course, they're, managed by the Scottish Government. And you did wonder where all this information went to. But it did seem to take away from the fact, from the event itself, because people were kind of a bit like, oh, now I have to do this.
Yes, I know.
And you sort of think, well, surely a body like Creative Scotland would already understand what the benefits were of putting on an art event or an exhibition already. And surely we seem to have disconnected from having just that an understanding of what it means to enjoy art, enjoy music.
We've disconnected from our humanity, and it's running on apace. And, you remind me that when I went to talk at UCLA, the University of California in Los Angeles last year, I was sent a lot of paperwork beforehand that I had to fill in, which was about my demographics and things that I had to try and work into my lecture, statements of a semi-political nature. And I just thought, this has nothing to do with what I'm really saying. Again, I ticked some random boxes and did what I wanted. But it is hideous. There's a wonderful paper, a genuine paper by a statistician saying, the data are lousy, but they're the only ones we've got. Now, anyone who knows anything about data knows that lousy data are worse than useless.
Yes.
They will completely distort what you do. So somehow we think data is so important that even if they're in pain, they have nothing to do with reality. Yeah. We really must follow those instead of the reality.
Yeah. Ian, what do you think is a hope for the future? If we're continuing down this path, what hope is there?
Well, I think there are good grounds for hope. I think the first thing is that an enormous number of people will probably resonate with what I've just said. I mean, that's my experience. Whenever I speak, people say, thank you, you just articulated what I was thinking. And particularly what I love is that young people, when I talk, often come up to me and are particularly moved. And so I always enjoy when I have to talk to young people, because you get this really vibrant feeling that they're on side and it's their future.
Yes.
So I think there's awareness. I think we need to do everything we can to raise awareness. So something like my being able to do this is helpful. People are widely reading and talking about my work. I now find that I'm talked about in the Sunday papers in London and on television and so on. And in fact, I contributed in a small way to the COVID inquiry by talking to one of the people who's just been reporting on what she experienced during it. So people are listening to my ideas, and that's very hopeful.
Yeah.
I think the young are passionate about doing whatever can be done to reverse the damage we've done to our planet, our home.
Yeah.
And I think there's another thing, which is people say, but what can I do because I'm so small? Well, there are a couple of things to say about that. One is that a lot of great changes have been made in our history that started with a small beginning and gathered enormous momentum. And so don't be discouraged by that. But I think if I may be allowed to strike a spiritual note at this point, I've come to realize as I've got older the enormous importance of a commitment to what one might call a spiritual vision of what we are, what we're doing here, how we relate to the world and to the wider cosmos. And that without it, whatever we do will not flourish. Because in a way what we're doing is we're putting sticking plasters, even if we did massive sticking plasters, like being able to stop the accelerating destruction of forests, the poisoning of the seas and so on. These are very big projects. But in the end, if we don't deal with the root cause of them, which is a complete turning of our backs on the realm of the sacred, the divine, the spiritual, whatever you like to call it, our values will be no different from the ones we now have, which are me, 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 more stuff, more utility for what? More material, more power. These are not how we should be spending the short time we have here to enjoy this glorious, complex, beautiful universe that we find ourselves the guests of for a while. We come out of it and we go back to it, and the best we can do here is to use that time to reorientate ourselves. And you can start that today. You can start thinking differently, less materially, less selfishly about a number of things, and try and reintegrate it into a bigger picture which has room in it for the holy, the good, the beautiful, the true. And those things have begun to disappear from our lives. Where do we see them anymore? Instead, it's all about power. It's all about money. It's all about the influence we can bring to bear.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. That's a lovely way to end. Christmas, it's Christmas time, Ian. What's your thoughts on Christmas? How do you spend Christmas?
Well, I do sometimes spend it with friends who come to stay. I have once spent it with my children, who are scattered around the world. And it takes quite some organizing getting them all from their various places to Sky. This year I will probably be spending it on my own. I don't mind at all, because it's the spirit of something that speaks of hope, a miracle, a rebirth, a re-sanctification of the earth. And, you know, that is such an important message. Even just thinking about it, I can feel shivers going up and down my spine. These are the things that really matter to us.
Yeah.
And we need to remember them and begin. And I just hope that more people will celebrate them in a way that is not just to do with feeding the economy, but feeding the soul.
Well, Ian, it's been a delight to be speaking with you today. Thank you very much for answering all my questions and just giving us a little bit of hope as we go into the next year and thinking about this time of year when it is a sort of chance to recalculate, to rethink how we do things, reassure ourselves that there is hope in the future if we just rethink things a little bit differently.
Indeed, indeed. Thank you, Susie.
You're very welcome, Ian. Thank you very much for coming to Radio Sky.